Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 2013, Columbus Metropolitan Libraries invested $120 million to relocate 6 branches and renovate 4 others. Perhaps more significantly, the system recently opened its first new branch in decades. This hour, we're talking about the changing landscape for libraries, from budget cuts to clientele to technology. Joining us now is Pat Lisinski, CEO of Columbus Metropolitan Libraries. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Pleasure to be here.
To give my first question a literary twist, let's put this in terms of maybe the Washington Irving character, Rip Van Winkle, who falls asleep and awakens in the next century. If Rip Van Winkle fell asleep in a library 100 years ago and woke up today, what would be different? Now, I know there'll be computers and the technology, but what else?
Well, first, Anne, I'm just glad you didn't think that I was around 100 years ago, so thanks for the reference.
Me either, just for the record.
So I think one of the big differences that you would notice right away was, even early on in my career, libraries were a place that someone came to request help to get information that was almost solely in the mind and expertise of the librarian. Today, it is much more of a facilitative role that the librarians have in terms of engaging our customers. And so I think the walking in is just a very different relationship. And I think part of what you sense as a difference in the libraries is how people access information, how they create knowledge, how they engage the librarians in that process. It's much more of a two-way street today as opposed to a one-way street. I think particularly in the Columbus Metropolitan Library, for years and years, my predecessor Larry Black talked about customer service. So that's been the hallmark of our award-winning staff. They have so much pride in the relationship building and the connection that they create in the staff. I think that's what you see that was probably very different from our grandmother and grandfather's library experience.
When we were afraid of the librarian,
I think so. And now it's about how are we accessible, approachable? How do we engage our people? And really, I couldn't be more proud of the people at Columbus Metropolitan, because they really believe it, they have the passion, and they live it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about libraries today and libraries of the future. They're planning that today. Pat Lisinski, CEO of Columbus Metropolitan Libraries, is my guest this hour. We'll have other guests coming on as well. If you have a question or comment, an observation about how libraries have changed, give us a call, 614-292-8513. On July 12th, Columbus Metropolitan Libraries opened their newly relocated Driving Park Library branch. If you've been to the branch and want to tell us about it, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Pat Lisinski, you have photos you've been showing me of all the kids in the library, and is there some place people can go to see those photos for themselves?
I don't have these posted, but okay. I would tell you the
it's from his private library.
The best vantage point is to drive to the corner of Kelton and Livingston to see this new building in the community. By the way, the city has helped us create a temporary street sign on the corner. The street sign is Reading Matters, and yes, it does. But to walk into that library and see the excitement and see the children using the technology, reading, using the educational resources, it's just been very rewarding for all of us.
Why did you choose that location?
Driving Park was one of our oldest branches. It was more than 40 years old. And the smallest branch in the system as well. And it, built way before we had computers and the technology. And it was just, it had been undersized and not the right building for years and years. And so when we did a comprehensive study for all of our library buildings, 22 throughout the county, and we really tried to prioritize, Driving Park went quickly to the top because of the condition of the current building. And so, it's just been a great success after opening it.
How do you decide in an age of shrinking revenues, how do you decide when it's time to renovate, possibly time to relocate? What are the specs on that? What are you looking at? When Driving Park rose to the top immediately, what was it?
Well, sometimes it can just be the physical condition of the buildings. Buildings just wear out over time. Sometimes it can be the availability of parking. You know, perhaps another difference, the first question you asked me about the difference between libraries of 100 years ago versus today, these libraries are community centers. So if you go into 8 or 9 of our branches today, in the summertime, you'll see that we've taken over the school nutrition program, and we're serving lunch to kids with the help of City of Columbus and the Rec and Park Department. So there's such an influx of people all the time, so you have to have parking available. Do you have enough seating? Driving Park was way undersized in terms of the number of computers available. It's probably a little known fact for our listeners that many people who come in to use our libraries, this might be the only access point they have to a personal computer. So they might have a smartphone, but if it's time to use a computer, maybe I don't own a computer. Or maybe I own a computer, but I don't have broadband access. Maybe I have a computer and broadband access, but there are 5 people who live in the home, and so we need more capacity. So people come in, they reserve computers. It's a self-service process. It works great. But we have great data in terms of how many people actually do that. And so on an annual basis, 2 million people come in, or there are 2 million sessions that people reserve time to use a computer. And we say, where else would they get access to the digital network? So you can think about our electric utility and our gas utility. Public library is the public computing utility. And so back to your question about, you know, why Driving Park, when people were waiting over an hour after they requested a reservation because we simply don't have enough computers, it was an easy call that they were, you know, rising to the top of the list.
Right. For those who haven't made it over to the new Driving Park branch, it has an unusual architectural design. Can you tell us about the design and what the purpose was? Because in this day and age, if you're a public building, you have to have purpose in every corner.
Absolutely. Well, we believe, and it was part of our overall building program itself, that the building had to be more than just a place that housed the services. It had to tell the story of the library. So let me tell you why that's important. Because we know from research that's been done in the library profession that library use is a habit. And some people who did not have a good educational experience equate that negative feeling with library use. So they just say, this is something I've never done, and use the library. We wanted these buildings to be very transparent. And so you see this absolutely in the Driving Park Library. The whole streetscape is glass. We want people to walk by, bicycle by, wait for the bus, drive their car. We want them to be able to see in that building, not only to see the resources and the technology, most importantly, we want them to see their neighbors' children. Suddenly we say, well, I've never used the library, but now here's a chance for me to go in there and experience it for the first time. And I think the library itself is a marketing tool to make sure we're getting the greatest value, the greatest use of those resources that the public has invested in.
One of the things I always remember about one of my favorite reporters at the Columbus Dispatch, Holly Zachariah, is that she grew up across the street from a library in a little town north of here, and that was a big, huge influence on her life. She could just walk over there every day and spend the day at the library. And I always remember that. I didn't have that luxury. I had to ride my bike a mile to get to the bookmobile, which I did. But how much freedom do children have to go into a library today on their own?
Well, first of all, we have an age requirement about how old you must be to be in the library on your own. And some people think that this is actually a very young age. By policy, it's actually age 7.
Oh, okay.
And,
it's younger than I thought.
It's younger than most people think. And yet what we find in many of our neighborhoods throughout the city is that sometimes we'll have a 7-year-old who might be paired up with a sibling who's age 5 who's coming into the library.
Wow.
So when we think of, particularly in the summertime, the options that that child might or might not have available to them, I think the library is a really important place for them to be. So we're trying to encourage as much attendance by children as possible, and so that's why the policy is what it is.
What demographics are you looking to attract? Grade school students, researchers, casual readers? Who are they?
Well, the top priority of the library system as a whole right now is what we've named Young Minds. And we're trying to encourage learning and growth. And our outcome that we try to define is how do you create a foundation for a successful life? So we know reading is an essential skill. And you've had a series of programs recently about prisons. Well, we know one of the common characteristics of the prison population is illiteracy. All right, so how do we focus on just the basics of learning to read? So we're engaged with all of the 10 school districts that we serve, an emphasis right now on Columbus, because we're looking at kindergarten readiness scores. We know these children are arriving at school and they're not ready for kindergarten. They don't have the basic letter awareness, sounds, rhyming, and the rest. So how do we instill some of those skills in a resource that's in the out-of-school time? And that's before someone actually goes to school. So the Driving Park branch has a kindergarten readiness zone. It's a very small area where kids can begin to experience what kindergarten might look like. And so, that's really where our focus has been. That leads to third grade reading guarantee. There's been so much discussion about the children who may not pass that test, may have to repeat third grade. How do we utilize library resources to create that foundation for success, not just in kindergarten and third grade, but throughout the educational continuum and into career?
How much are you in partnership with the school system and with the city when it comes to these issues?
Well, I would say that we think we're linked with them. I served on Mayor Coleman's Education Commission, so I understand firsthand what some of those issues are. I think the commission members, we're always struck by the fact that we have almost 7 million visitors a year to all of our libraries, and yet at some level people are surprised to find out what's happening in the library. So, but I think we were able to share these are the resources of the library that we can deploy across neighborhoods, and then through our virtual network, we can deliver electronically as well. So we're working very closely with them. Dr. Good, the superintendent of Columbus City Schools, has been very open to our efforts to start book delivery to classrooms in the elementary schools from the public library. We've established a Reading Buddies program where volunteers are coming into our library to sit with children and to just listen to them read, help them sound out words, test them on their comprehension skills when they're done. We have homework help centers now in all of these locations. And for years, children have been telling their parents, oh, I'm going to the library to work on homework. Well, now it's a more formal process where we have dedicated space and we have volunteers and staff members who are helping. Over 80,000 visits a year to our 22 locations of kids coming in for homework help. So we think our partnership with Columbus City Schools and other school districts really has never been stronger.
My guest is Pat Lazinski. He's CEO of Columbus Metropolitan Libraries. We're talking about the future of the library in Columbus and across the country. On July 12th, Columbus Metropolitan Libraries opened their newly relocated Driving Park Library branch. That is one of several that will be relocated in coming years. If you have a question or comment for Pat Lazinski, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Those who have seen the Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life, will no doubt remember the look on George Bailey's face when he learns that his would-be wife has instead become, of all possible horrors, a librarian.
Tell me where she is.
You're not going to like it, George.
Where is she?
She's an old maid. She never married.
Where is Mary? Where is she? Where is she?
She's just about to close up the library.
Oh, man, stereotypes, however, are the least of the challenges that face today's librarians. Budget cuts and concurrent staff cuts, longer hours and rapidly changing technology are but a few. Still with us, Columbus Metropolitan Library's CEO, Pat Lazinski. Once again, Pat, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, man.
And joining us now is the author of The Challenges of Library Learning. He's director of libraries at Columbus State Community College, Bruce Massis. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Bruce, you've written a number of books over the years about the challenges of managing libraries. Let's just cut to the chase and say that funding has a lot to do with a lot of stuff.
Indeed it does. And we have lived with the same mantra for years in libraries, which is doing more with less. We'd love to be able to get to the point where we were doing more with more, but that doesn't seem to be happening. And I'm saying decades this has been going on.
Right.
So librarians are really good at managing money, and library managers really have to be excellent at managing the organizational money. Besides looking for grants and other opportunities, you know, grants are not sustainable, but for special projects at least, we've been writing many, many grants over the course of the years, federal, state, local grants, to be able to support some of the programs and services that we offer. And I think the importance of having these partnerships that we've engaged in over the course of the last few years, more and more these days, like the ones that we have with Columbus Metropolitan Library now. I'm glad you have Pat on because we can talk a little bit about what this partnership is about.
Yeah.
We need to all survive. And a lot of us recognize that we're working with the same audience, especially in community colleges and public libraries. These are our users, both ours and the public library. They use us both. They come to us for certificates and degrees. They go to the public library for research and development and other programs, and it's a natural match.
There's no shortage of librarians out there or people who want to be librarians, right? There's plenty of people who want to do what George was horrified to learn his would-be wife had done.
There are, and there are well over 50 accredited library schools in the U.S. That offer the Master's in Library and Information Science. And here in town, we have Kent State that has a home in the State Library that also offers a degree. Plus, there are degrees offered online. So you can get the MLIS very easily these days. And I say MLIS because it's a lot more, it's a lot different than the original MLS, which is a lot more technology-driven material that students are learning. So one of the things we've done at Columbus State is we have filled our circulation desk with graduate library school students so they can get some practical experience on the job before they finish their degrees. And we've hired a number of them at graduation. So it's been a really good partnership with Kent State because we're using a lot of their graduated students.
You know, 91% of Americans think libraries are important to their communities, but you're right. Over the past two decades, funding for libraries, and particularly over the past two decades, funding has shrunk. At the state level, it's been monumental cutbacks in just the last 10 years, 10 or 15 years. So what's behind the funding shortage? Is it are we changing how we say we value libraries? That's according to Pew Research Center. 91% think they're important, but we're not putting our money where our mouth is. What's the disconnect?
I think the disconnect is that libraries, in my experience, have always seemed like an easy hit for legislators, where it's an easy cut. We'll cut a few thousand this year, a few thousand next year, and on and on and on. And many libraries are working on 1990 budgets, $1990. Try operating your own home budget on $1990. It'd be a little difficult to do. And yet, when you go to legislative days and meet with the legislators, they're fully behind you. We love libraries. I remember my first experience in a library, and it goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow that doesn't get translated into the real world. So we have to continue to lobby, and we have an excellent lobbying arm in ALA, American Library Association in this country, and abroad as well. They're facing the same issues in foreign libraries as we are here.
Pat Leszczynski?
I think what I would add is that I think what you see happening in the state of Ohio as it relates to public library funding is the same strategy or philosophy over multiple administrations now mm-hmm. about moving local funding back to local and away from state, so be it local governments or townships and others. What we say as it relates to libraries, however, is many of those other entities have other ways to raise revenue. Fortunately, in Ohio, we have the ability to also seek voter support through a levy. And I think I was on your show around 2010 when we passed our levy, which was at a very challenging time because we were at sort of at the depths of the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And we were asking for additional funds to make up for some of those losses from the state. And countywide, we passed that levy 2-1, and I think we lost 2 precincts countywide. So in our mind, that shows the unbelievable popularity of public libraries and what we're doing and the value that people see in them. But I would also say for our staff, it also rededicates ourselves to say, with that level of support, we have to exceed expectations of our customers as well.
And I would agree with that. I think what's really become important in the public's mind is the essential nature of a library service. And we see this over and over again where funding is threatened to be cut in different locales around the country. And the public steps up to the plate and helps get the funding restored. This morning in the Miami Herald, it was reported that Miami-Dade Public Library, which was facing massive cuts, some of the monies will be restored by the virtue of a slight rise in property taxes based on individual users walking around City Hall and with signage saying we need our libraries. So it's the public that steps up and really works for us in terms of getting funding restored. And you see this over and over again.
So, Ann, I want to step back about what we started this segment with, the It's a Wonderful Life quote and, you know, the horrors of Mary Bailey becoming a librarian. You know, the great thing that we see from young librarians who are coming out is they're not saddled with the stereotype
right.
that our generation is. They say, well, I don't understand that because people coming into the profession fresh understand that it's about technology, it's about teaching children, it's about relationships, and I think we're going to see that fade over time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the future of libraries in Columbus and in Franklin County in our society. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. You want to talk about the trend toward the digital. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Yes, I'm in the south side of Columbus. On our Parsons Avenue, there's plans for a new branch. The meeting for it was very heavily attended by one segment of the users, but by virtually none of other segment of the users. And there's some concerns I have with the physical properties, but my main concern is both myself and another neighbor had discussions with the chair of the Columbus Library Board, and he indicated the professional trends are very much away from physical collections and very much towards, I guess you would say, digital media. That works very well for basically the library. Our library has been turning into an internet cafe and social service and recreation center. But there are a significant number of people who like physical collections, books, mm-hmm. CDs, DVDs, magazines, comics, even artwork like they do at the Worthington Library. And some of us are thinking of perhaps forming our own informal libraries, walkable libraries in areas with physical collections, since the public libraries seem to think that's not so important.
Well, let's
wondered about if this part of the market can be addressed, at least for Columbus.
Well, that's a good question. You have your
great question. We
talked about attracting youth, you know, that younger element to the libraries,
right.
But you still have a really broad spectrum of clientele, and your best customers of all are the ones who have been with you the longest, and they happen to start out with books.
Yep, and I appreciate the question because we haven't had a chance to talk about this topic yet. We're living in two worlds right now. We're living in the analog world of the book, and we're living in the digital world of downloading materials as well. I can tell you that our book budget today at Columbus Metropolitan Library has never been higher than it is in 2014. So we have not at all given up on the book. We are also buying e-books that are able to be downloaded directly from the library's website. So I want to encourage our listeners who may not be aware of that service. You can use your card to download right to your device. This year, it'll be about 1 million downloads from our customers.
Wow. And I remember back in the day when they were struggling with, how are we going to do this?
Well,
how are we going to compete?
That's right. But I would also tell you that our physical circulation of books is going to be 14.5 million. So we pay a great deal of attention to that. And not only do we have the materials that are in our libraries, but over the past 2 years, we have joined with, we now are up to 14 libraries throughout Central Ohio that all share a catalog together. So collectively, we've grown the Columbus system of 3 million items to 4.5 million items. So when customers go online, they see all of those materials. And we're now pulling in information and books from Marysville, Alexandria, Lancaster, all throughout. So, I want to reiterate, we've absolutely not given up on the book. It's still, you know, the traditional part of libraries is still there alongside the new.
One foot in each world, is that part of one of these management issues that all libraries are dealing with?
Yeah, because it becomes a balance for managers. If you have a finite number of dollars, what do you spend on digital materials? What do you spend on print materials? And often you have audiences that want one or the other or both. And with a finite budget, you have to make some hard choices. One of I'm glad Pat mentioned the partnerships that he's got with these other libraries, because Columbus State, as a member of OhioLINK, the statewide consortium, our borrowers now have access to 50, 60 million items out there from any library who's a member of OhioLINK, and that's 90 libraries. So we've expanded the size of our physical collection by virtue of being in a consortium, which is great value for the money because it provides us with borrowed books that we can lend, borrowed books that people can borrow, as well as databases that people can access that we wouldn't normally have purchased on our own.
Well, you have some communique by way of email and tweet. Lady OSU 0828 wrote, "My 27-year-old daughter just moved to D.C., Virginia area. She said the Columbus Library system far exceeds what they have." An email from Angel. She writes, "I'm so glad to hear that the Shepherd branch is being expanded. My sisters at age nine and seven would walk across the Fifth Avenue Bridge over 670 to go there. My only issue is that the library requires a credit check for the Reading Buddy program. I understand a background check, but a credit check might discourage some people from applying, even if they have great credit. I was a Reading Buddy in Columbus Public Schools this past year." Why the credit check?
You know, I have to tell you, Ann, I'm actually not familiar with it, so I'd have to go back
all
and
right,
check
Angel.
Actually what we're doing, but thanks for the comment. I'll follow up.
Right. An email from Gina. "I am only supportive of libraries to the extent that I trust the integrity of their nonfiction content. But in the last 15 to 20 years, the trustworthiness of the supposedly factual content of books and other media has changed due to authors who intentionally mislead or advance political or other views. How can libraries work to advance the integrity of information of our culture without censorship?" An interesting larger question, particularly as we enter and get 2 feet into the digital world.
Well, I think in terms of what our mission is at Columbus State, our mission as a library is to support the curriculum. So the material that is suggested that we purchase more often than not, comes from the faculty. And the value of having that sort of a partnership with our own faculty is that we'll have discussions about what's important, what's necessary, what do they really need for their classes, should it be in print, should it be in digital. Over the last couple of years, we have moved a lot of our print periodical subscriptions to digital. And a lot of that had to do with accreditation, where certain departments need to be accredited by their accrediting agencies, but the accrediting agencies were indicating that we had to have certain materials only in print. they're moving away from that now. It's been a slow move, but mm-hmm. most of those departments now are the accrediting agencies for those departments are now fine with us having the material only in digital format. So it goes back to how we spend the dollars again. Because of the accreditation issue, we were buying them in both camps. We were buying print and digital. Now at least we can move just to one format to be able to present the material.
What an incredible responsibility! You think about what you get to pick. You get to pick what people get to read.
Yeah, and I'm going to go back to your first question that you asked when we started the show again about the difference between libraries of 100 years ago or today. You know, that responsibility is so much more challenging today, because even when I started in libraries 30 years ago, I think about the review journals that would come out. They were reviewed by peers. There was almost a validation that occurred in that selection process. Think about it today in terms of a digital environment, a self-publishing environment, authors able to get their own reviews, if you will, mm-hmm. and you wonder about how that process occurs. And so we do our best to always acquire the best and most accurate information. But I think it is, you know, still it's always about the user taking responsibility for it and checking those sources, because it's just a much more dynamic environment today than it was in the past.
That's what we're talking about this hour. If you have a question or comment about the future of libraries, give us a call, 614-292-8513. I'll get to the callers who are waiting. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Still staying with us, Bruce Massis, he's Director of Libraries at the Columbus State Community College, and also Pat Lazinski, he's CEO of Columbus Metropolitan Libraries. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Fly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow. I can go anywhere. Friends to know.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Reading Rainbow, hosted by LeVar Burton, is an iconic PBS children's series. It ran from 1983 to 2006. And the idea was to nurture a love of reading and books in children. But in the digital age, books aren't enough. We've been talking about that. According to researchers, modern library users want to do more than simply take a look in a book. Still with us, Columbus Metropolitan Library's CEO Pat Lazinski and Columbus State Community College Director of Libraries Bruce Massis. Joining us now is the Online Computer Library Center's Senior Research Scientist, Dr. Lynn Conaway. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Lynn, at OCLC, you're the leader of the user behavior studies. How are people getting their information today?
Well, people are getting their information from many different sources, and that's what's very difficult for libraries today. Of course, the first place that people will often mention is a browser, and you know, one of the most famous browsers, Google. So Google comes up a lot. Other things that come up that I think people don't really think about are other people, so human resources. And that's very, very popular. They will text, they will chat, they will call. If the person sitting next to me and I think they may know, they would ask that person. So that's another venue. We also look at we never put words into individuals' mouths. So we ask them questions of how do you get information, who do you go to, and when libraries come up, and again, we don't mention libraries.
Right.
When libraries
no
come
leading
up.
Leading the witness,
yes.
Right? Okay.
Books, books and libraries are equated. And so I was listening to the conversation earlier about books, and people still associate libraries with books. Now, that's good, and in some ways it's unfortunate.
Because it's so much more.
It's so much more. And even though libraries offer online services I think that the way we offer them are so seamless that people don't even realize they're using the library. And so that may be a sort of a marketing point for us, because they are using our services. And when we probe, we learn that they truly are using services provided by the libraries.
Pat Lazinski, did you want to say something? Okay.
I'll piggyback on that for a second, because I think that your comment about libraries are so much more is excellent. There are examples, especially in public libraries, of public libraries have the ability to respond directly to the community, which is one of their great strengths. And there are libraries out there that are not lending just books or just technology anymore. We know they lend iPads. We know they lend laptops, e-readers, all those other things. But there are libraries out there that are lending cake pans. They're lending tools. They're lending fishing rods. And they're lending drones. 2 weeks ago, University of South Florida indicated that it would start lending drones for their photography students so they can take overhead pictures. So anything you can put a barcode on, you can lend.
Yes, a library.
Well, I there may be those out there. I can tell you I have no plans to lend cake pans or fishing rods at Columbus Metropolitan. I think, but it does illustrate, frankly, one of our challenges for years and years. If you look at the downtown main library over the front door, it says open to all. And we've always struggled with the notion that if we turn that wonderful statement into we're going to be all things to all people, we're probably going to be below average at a lot of things. So we're still open to all. Come in and discover. We want to support your individual interests. But in terms of where we have to concentrate our resources to try to create the right outcomes, you know, those are hard choices that libraries need to make. And I think that's what you're seeing more and more in libraries.
I kind of get the connection of the fishing pole, though. I think of it like, say, you're a bird watcher and you're reading a book about birds. Well, here, we're going to lend you a pair of binoculars. And now you can go out and take that experience one step further. Is that sort of what they're doing?
Yeah, and they're responding to the community directly. This particular library that does that, there's two of them that I know of. One's on Long Island, so you're right near Long Island Sound. You can go fishing. And the other one is upstate New York near the Thousand Lakes region. So you can fish up there. It's great fishing.
That's the point, you're getting people in the library.
And that's a lot of what it's about, too. It's a recognition that the library is there to serve all. I'll go back to what Pat said about serving all. And there are many ways to serve all.
Now, you all have a collaboration you're working on. We talked earlier about your work with the city and the schools district, but Columbus State and Columbus Metropolitan Libraries are working together on as well.
We're really excited about the partnerships that have been developing here over the last 12 to 15 months, and I'll let Bruce share some of what they've done. But what we're really excited about in the new Driving Park Library is we actually have dedicated space where we will be offering admissions counseling, and actually at some point we'll actually offer courses right in the Driving Park Library. Why is that important? It's important because that neighborhood happens to serve many first-generation college students. And even navigating the Columbus State campus can be really intimidating for someone who does not have a support system in place. Perhaps parents who have not gone to college. So it's just difficult to navigate everything from financial aid to course selection to work with guidance counselors. So we're going to try and offer that, or we will be offering that right in Driving Park. President Dave Harrison from Columbus State, when we were talking about this, I think he captured it just perfectly. He said, Pat, we want to be the Starbucks to your Barnes & Noble in that library. And, you know, at some point, As we continue this partnership in the new buildings that we're building, Columbus State now has a broader footprint throughout Central Ohio, and that's terrific.
What's been the reaction from students? And
well, it's interesting. At the opening of the Driving Park branch on Saturday, as we opened the doors, two Columbus State students came into the Columbus State room and started working on their online courses while there are thousands of people walking around the branch. So they couldn't wait. And we did a zip code survey looking at all of the Columbus Metropolitan Library branches, matching it up with the numbers of students we have around those branch neighborhoods. And we have over 10,000 Columbus State students that are living in the areas that are covered by the Columbus Metropolitan Library branches. So it's a natural match. So one of the things that we did right off the bat was our IT department, after years of research, was able to develop a virtual infrastructure for online learning, where we have been able to put, along with Columbus's IT department, we've been able to put an icon on every Columbus Metropolitan Library computer, where any Columbus State student can now log in at any of the Columbus Metropolitan Library branches as a student and get into the Columbus State system, because they can do their online learning, they can get library resources from our library and other services. So this is groundbreaking. I mean, I have not seen this before.
Yeah, Lynn Conaway, is this something that people are saying they need and want, or are they not necessarily able to even articulate it because it doesn't really exist most places?
I think people are articulating what they want. I think it's what we've learned is it's very dependent upon the context and situation of the need. And so that's what's very difficult. So at one moment, I may be near one of these branch libraries and I'm a student and I need this information now, right then. It may also be that I'm sitting in a library and I may want some help. I have a question. And instead of standing up and asking a reference librarian who may be sitting right there, I go on virtually and ask the librarian. And so why? Because it's more convenient. I'm sitting here. I may not want to get up. I may not want to leave my things. And so I think what's happening is individuals have all different options for getting information, and what they really want is that information in the format, the medium, at that moment that fits their need.
So to what extent is, say, Columbus Metropolitan Libraries online?
For this coursework for the library itself?
The library itself.
Well, I think I mentioned earlier the number of physical visitors
right.
at around 7 million. It mirrors about 7 million individual visits to the library's website as well. And so what people are accessing are things that are way beyond the basic web of a Google search. These are subscription resources that we have around magazines or other research material that people are going on to supplement the work that they do. It could be for work, could be a small business person. That type of thing is happening through the library's website
as well. A lot of times in my work, I'm coming across abstracts that don't give me access to the full document because you have to pay for it. That's something I could maybe turn to the library for and find out
if you... You better be dusting off your card, Anne.
Yes.
Because indeed...
I hadn't thought about that before, but it just struck me.
Right. Many of those resources are probably the ones that we're paying for. You know, it's not exhaustive, but
right.
we purchase those subscriptions because users... do not have to be in the library. There are some vendors that require an on-site presence, but many of them are mobile so that you can access it not only from the library, but from your remote location, office, or home as well, just with the library card and the barcode that you enter into the system.
Hmm. Lynn Conaway, tell us about the idea of embedded librarianship. What is that, and what does it mean in terms of implementation?
Some universities are practicing this, and I have been thinking of ways also of public libraries of doing this. And basically, the librarians are a part of the class. Sometimes the students do not even know that the librarian isn't a student in the class. And so the librarian provides assistance, works on projects with the students. Sometimes the librarian's office is actually in the department with the specific subject area. So they can be virtual as well. So with online classes, the librarian follows the class. Often there's instruction, And what we have been finding is that if there is instruction, the instruction needs to be based on some need. You can give this broad-based instruction about all of the resources available in the library, but if I don't need it at that moment, I probably won't retain it. And so if I need something within this class and the librarian is explaining it to me, we found that if it's one resource, often those individuals will use that resource no matter what, because they that worked once. And so it's something that they remember. And I think also with the embedded librarian, I think we need to be within our communities. And so I talked about the academic side. But on the public side, I mean, many cities have kiosks in their in the town. Hmm. And you can go up and ask questions. I used this as an example in a chapter that I wrote in a book looking at Library 2020. And the town of Aspen has a little town kiosk. And so when you go up and ask questions, people answer them. And so I asked one day, are you affiliated with the library? Oh, no, we're just volunteers. We like to sit here and talk to people. And so I thought, wouldn't this be a perfect way for the library to promote what they know and what they're doing? Several years ago, I was in Washington, D.C. in the summer, and there were individuals walking on the street with yellow T-shirts. Now, I'm not promoting yellow T-shirts for librarians, but they had yellow T-shirts with information written on them. At the time, I did not need any information, but again, I went up and said, excuse me, I need to find such and such. And they gave me a map and gave me instructions and said, oh, you might want to look at this on the way. And I said, oh, are you affiliated with the library? And they said, no. And so I thought, wow, this is another great way just to be there.
Pat Lozinski?
Well, you know, Lynn's talking about the power of information and virtual resources. So the staff from Columbus Metropolitan emailed me, and we, to answer an earlier caller's question or comment, we don't perform credit checks on our volunteers. They're just criminal background checks. So I just want to
Setting the record straight on that. Email from Valerie. The embedded idea is very interesting, but it could cost money.
Everything costs money, but what I'm thinking is we reallocate staff and our resources, and I'm sure that's been coming up quite a bit this morning as well.
We've talked a lot about integrating the library more into our everyday lives, like it used to be, but in today's everyday life. And does this resonate with you, Pat, or Bruce? Does that?
Well, I think where we've really created our focus, if you want to think about this embedding concept, it's really in the schools. Mm. So we think about our children's librarians going out in the late spring to really talk about the summer reading program. Okay, we're trying to create that connection in the school so that we're saying during the summer months, we're going to have opportunities for you to participate in a reading program that's not only going to help you retain, you know, this is part of this is the message to the teachers, not necessarily the children. We're trying to help students retain their reading skills over the summer months by participating in that activity over the summer. So when we create that relationship and it's cemented in the school, it continues during those critical 3 months of the summertime as well. So that's really where Columbus, I think, is deploying most of the embedded librarian concept.
And we, Columbus State is very much an initiative now called a dual enrollment initiative, mm-hmm. where we have high school students who are taking Columbus State courses in the high schools. And it goes along with a lot of what Columbus Metro's approach has been to design these branches, where it's a full educational experience, where the high school students for us are learning, they're getting credit for college courses before they get to Columbus State. We're hoping they select Columbus State. Same thing with our partnership with Columbus Metro, where we have students that will know us from K up, mm-hmm. and hopefully we'll select Columbus State.
Okay. Well, Bruce Massis, thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you.
Bruce Massis, he is the Director of Libraries at Columbus State Community College. Dr. Lynn Conaway, Online Computer Library Center's Senior Research Scientist. Thanks so much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And Pat Lazinski, CEO of Columbus Metropolitan Libraries. Thanks to you.
Thanks, Ann.
Emily Williams helped produce this show. Thanks to Emily Williams and the rest of the All Sides staff. And thanks to you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.